The army's responsible for the death of that little girl?
She pushes through, gets around the corner of the building, and Sanchez is behind her. And bless Pierce and Huang, they hang back, block the reporters, trying to give her a few seconds to herself. There's low brush, plastic bags of trash, broken bottles, wooden pallets leaning up against the concrete block wall. Ventilation fans hum in the side of the building. A dirt lot bordered by brush and saplings. A green dumpster is next to the rear entrance of the coffee shop. She stops, sees a puddle near the bottom of the metal container where grease, waste, and other nasty fluids have seeped out. Clouds of flies are buzzing around the open cover. Sanchez says, "Damn," but he's smiling at her, like he's daring her. Dare taken. She steps up to the dumpster, grabs the greasy metal edge, hauls herself up, and falls in, losing a shoe in the process. York tries breathing through her mouth, but it's hard to keep focused. She's knee-deep in trash, sludge, bottles, empty cans. No recycling program here in Sullivan County. There are vegetable peelings, cold mashed potatoes, clumps of grease, chewed rib bones, crumpled and soiled napkins, chicken bones. So many flies are buzzing and hovering that she's afraid she's going to swallow some. Get to work, she thinks. Get to work. Using bare hands, damn it, why didn't she get a pair of gloves before diving in so quickly? She moves piles of trash, broken green bags, more trash and peelings and sludge tumbling out. And she makes a mistake, breathing through her nose, and her mouth starts filling with saliva. Nausea is coming at her in waves. "You okay in there, Agent York?" Sanchez asks from outside. She's afraid if she tries to talk, the vomiting will begin, and she doesn't want to give him the satisfaction. In a corner is a pile of smaller, white plastic trash bags, like the ones motel and hotel maids use on their carts. She trudges over, breathing hard, something sharp poking her left leg, and she tears open the near bag. Crumpled paper towels, used tissues, scraps of plastic, and bits of paper. Notepaper. Sopped through with coffee. Connie carefully unfolds the notes, laying out the little bits of paper on a nearby piece of cardboard. CNN, The New York Times, Atlanta Journal-Constitution. A note in careful cursive with a phone number at the bottom. "Dear Army officer, it would really make me happy to talk to you about what happened at the summer house. Sincerely, Peggy Reese." Connie memorizes the phone number, folds up the wet paper, puts it into her coat pocket. The flies are so thick that it looks like ashes are falling from the sky. She stumbles through the piles again, gets to the wall, and hauls herself up and over, falling to the ground. Sanchez is there and steps back, bringing a hand up to his face. "God, Agent York, you stink!" She sits up against the dumpster. "Nice powers of observation. Give me my bag, will you?" There's just a passing look in Sanchez's eyes. "What am I, your gopher?" But he does as he's told, and he brings over her bag. She digs out her cell phone and makes the call to Peggy Reese of the Sullivan County Times. No answer. She can hear the voices of reporters out there beyond the brush and piles of trash. Sanchez squats down next to her. "We'll try later," she says.
"I don't like it," Sanchez says. "You talk with reporters, you always get screwed."
"Well, good for the investigation that I don't agree with you." York goes back into the bag, takes out her Iridium 9555 satellite phone, powers it up, waits a moment, and then dials a pre-programmed number. Ring. 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 Nothing. Sanchez says,
"I thought these phones have worldwide coverage."
"Most times," she says. "Most times." Damn it, she thinks as the crowd of reporters plows its way through and starts asking questions, taking photos, pushing and shoving. A horrible thought comes to her. The last time she saw their boss, he was walking into 4th Battalion headquarters. But that doesn't mean he got on a transport to Afghanistan now, does it? Maybe the reason the sat phone isn't getting answered is that it's not in his possession. Maybe he's in detention somewhere back at Hunter. Where's Major Cook? Chapter 55. In his cell at the Ralston Town Jail, Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson makes a decision and then gets off his bunk. Funny, when the decision is made, then it's done. You go out and do the job and respond to emerging threats and situations, but there's no second guessing. Not in the Rangers. You learn lessons at some point, but when you set off on a mission, there's no looking back. Ever. At the other end of the block, one of the jail attendants with a meal cart is passing out an early supper, usually barely warm hot dogs and untoasted buns, a bag of chips, a mustard packet, a juice box. Jefferson wraps the old metal bars with his hands and says, "Hey, you down there. I need to see the chief straight away." The attendant is a chubby, surly young boy wearing a tan uniform and light blue latex gloves. He says, "I'll get to him soon enough. I'm doing my job here." "And doing it so fine," Jefferson says, and he goes back and sits down on his bunk. A couple of minutes later, the young boy comes back, drops a paper plate with the supper on it, and shoves it into Jefferson's cell with a foot. Then he leaves, pushing the meal cart before him. The ranger picks up the two cold hot dogs, makes sure they've not been spit upon or tampered with, and in a few minutes, supper is finished. Corporal Barnes calls out, "Everything okay, Sergeant?" "It's perfect," he says, wiping his hands with two brown paper napkins. Specialist Ruiz says, "You sure, Sergeant? I don't remember this part coming up, you seeing the chief." Jefferson crumples up the napkins, steps up to the bars. Both Barnes and Ruiz are standing close to the bars of their respective cells, wearing the same dull orange jumpsuit as Jefferson. He tosses a crumpled napkin at each, and both go through the bars and strike their heads. "No turning back now, gentlemen," he says. He hears a metallic clatter of a door opening, and a still angry-looking Chief Kane strolls in. Jefferson has a funny thought that if the poor chief were to have a coronary and die right now, that angry look would probably stay on his face all the way through the funeral.
"What is it?"
Kane asks. Jefferson says, "Chief, we've been here a few days, and I've made a decision." The chief hitches a hand on his utility belt.
"What decision is that?"
"I want to meet with that army lawyer who's been trying to see me and the rest of my team. As soon as can be arranged, I want to meet him and I want the district attorney to be here at the same time."
Kane looks suspicious.
"Why the hell should I do that? You had your chance before. You turned it down. Why should I let you do it now?"
Jefferson drapes his big hands over one of the crossbars of his cell door.
"Because having us around here is a royal pain in the ass, isn't it, Chief? And wouldn't you like to get rid of us as soon as possible? Stop all the phone calls, all the news media banging on your door at all hours of the day. Get me that army lawyer and the district attorney and I'll make it happen."
"How?"
Kane asks. And in addition to the suspicion on his face, Jefferson sees something else in the man's eyes. Hope that this whole mess will go away. Jefferson grins, steps back from the barred door.
"Just you wait and see."
Chapter 56.
When I wake up, my Bruce Catton book on the Civil War is on the floor of the C-17, and I hear the whine of the engines as we prep to leave Ramstein after the hour-long refueling stop. I would love to bend down and pick up the book, but right now my body is in dull ache mode, and it's the best I've felt in the last few hours, so I stay still. The interior of this transport aircraft is huge, 88 feet in length and 18 feet in width, and most of the inside is taken up with pallets and containers of equipment for the 4th Battalion, tied down with web straps. Also along as cargo are three Rangers from Beta Company of the 4th Battalion, and in the flight to Germany they sat as a group on the starboard side of the aircraft. Only once did they pay attention to me, when they realized I had no food or water, and one of the specialists gave me a bottle of water and three energy bars. The aircraft sighs to a halt. We wait. Wait some more. In a forward area is a door marked lavatory, and beyond that is a small corridor leading to a galley. Next to that, a steep set of stairs leads up to the flight deck. The overhead curved ceiling is crammed with wires and conduits. On this mission, the craft has a loadmaster and three pilots, one acting as a reserve so each one can get some sleep. And across from me, one ranger nudges another, who nudges the third.
I look over. One of the pilots is coming down the stairs from the flight deck, not looking happy. I check my watch. It's almost 3 a.m. in Ramstein on Wednesday. The pilot comes over to me, leans down. He has captain's bars on his Air Force flight suit.
Got a problem here,
he says, voice loud over the sound of the four idling engines.
What's wrong?
I ask, knowing that whatever it is, it's all on me. He says,
got a flash message from the control tower. They want to know if I've got an army officer aboard named Cook. What did you say your name was again, back at Hunter?
I don't know why I do it, but there's something in the pilot's tone of voice, and I casually move my left hand over to the side of my chest. Give it a good scratch.
I didn't.
The pilot stares at me hard.
Mind telling me just what the hell you are, Major?
I'm an investigator with the CID. I need to get to Afghanistan because... Why is a very good question. I've thought about it over and over again in the long hours above the Atlantic, running through the investigation and what my crew and I have learned. And I've come to some sort of conclusion, but this will be the very first time I dare to say it aloud. I lift myself off the seat a bit so the pilot can hear every word, and even through the sudden pain, I make myself clear.
I need to get to Afghanistan because a team of Army Rangers is being railroaded, and I need to find evidence they're innocent before they get executed.
The pilot looks over at the three Army Rangers ready to go into combat in Afghanistan and turns back to me, nods.
Glad we got that cleared up, he says. Major?
He turns around and climbs up the steps to the flight deck. One of the Army Rangers sitting across from me gives me a brief nod, unbuckles from his seat and comes over. He doesn't say a word, but picks up my Bruce Catton book and hands it over to me. I nod and thanks, and he goes back to his place. I suppose if I was the investigator the NYPD and Army think I am, I would go over and try to interview these Rangers to see if they have any knowledge or feelings about the Ninja Squad. But I know in my gut that the real truth and evidence is not here, but where I'm headed. The engines roar louder and the large, lumbering C-17 maneuvers its way to takeoff. I'm ashamed to feel regret. Regret that I wasn't pulled from the aircraft. It would have been the easier and safer outcome. But ease and safety aren't in my future. Within a few more minutes, we're airborne again, heading for Bagram.
Chapter 57. Captain Alan Pierce is leaving the interior of a cluttered and busy restaurant called Four Corners Barbecue, located at the intersection of Route 119 and a local country road, when his smartphone rings. He puts down the plastic tray holding cold drinks for the squad and checks the phone's caller ID. Sees the call is coming from Sullivan District Attorney.
This is Pierce, he answers.
Most of the restaurant's seating is outside on worn, splintering wooden picnic tables, and the Army personnel are sitting at a far table underneath a large hickory tree. For once, they don't have the news media hovering around.
Hey, Captain, glad I caught up with you. How's your day going?
It's going well, Mr. Slate.
I hear you and your folks might be leaving soon, heading back home to Virginia. That true, son?
Pierce works his jaw as the old insult comes across his phone, said in a polite and soothing voice, a descendant of the master class establishing the correct order of things.
First, we're not leaving anytime soon, Mr. Slate, and second, I told you not to call me son. Understand?
Slate says, oh, sorry to offend you, Snowflake. That's what all you entitled members of society do nowadays is look for ways to be offended, isn't that right? Or is snowflake one of the forbidden words nowadays? Should I make a list then, make sure I don't hurt your tender feelings?
What do you want? Pierce says, struggling to keep his voice steady.
Well, it looks like the head ranger, Staff Sergeant Jefferson, has changed his mind. He wants to talk to me, and he demanded that you come along as well when we meet.
It feels like a sudden hot wind is buffeting him.
Are you sure?
Damn, I'm not going to win re-election in a few days because I'm not sure of my work. Of course I'm sure. He told Chief Kane over in Ralston that he wants a meeting as soon as possible with you and me. Now, and Pierce hears the sounds of paper shuffling, I've got a couple of appearances over in Chatham County Superior Court tomorrow, but I think I can manage to get over there this evening. Say 8 p.m., does that work?
Pierce could have had an appointment with the Georgia Lottery Corporation to receive a payout at 8 p.m., but there is no way he is going to miss this meeting.
I'll be there, he says. At the Ralston Jail?
That's right.
Do you know what Staff Sergeant Jefferson is considering?
Not a clue, but I bet we'll know soon enough now, won't we?
The district attorney chuckles and says,
See then, son.
Chapter 58. Less than 30 minutes after Captain Pierce has told them the news of Staff Sergeant Jefferson's change of heart, Special Agent Connie York and her squad are still at Four Corners Barbecue, seated at an outdoor picnic table sipping way too sweet iced tea and thinking through options and strategy when her smartphone rings. The number is anonymous, and before she answers, York says, It's settled then. Pierce, when you go to Ralston, I want Huang to go along. Another set of eyes and ears will prove helpful. Huang says, Glad to be there, ma'am. Nodding, York turns around on the picnic table bench, accepts the incoming call and says, Hello?
Who's this?
Comes a suspicious-sounding woman's voice.
This is Special Agent Connie York, Army CID.
Oh, the woman says.
Just wanted to make sure. I saw that you'd been calling me all day, leaving messages and such, but I wanted to make sure. This is Peggy Ree, Sullivan County Times.
York gets up and walks away from the table where Pierce, Sanchez, and Huang are still sitting, wanting to focus entirely on this call.
Mrs. Reese, I can't tell you.
She laughs.
Aw, hell, ma'am, I ain't no missus. You can call me Peggy.
And you can call me Connie, she says.
I would love a chance to talk with you.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice, she says. I'm afraid I'm busy for a bit with my Walmart shift.
But you said you were from the newspaper.
I am from the newspaper, she says. In fact, I was out this afternoon trying to sell ads and I left my damn cell phone at home. I also do photo work in most of the typesetting and with all that, I still can't make a living. But I'm a damn good reporter.
I see, York says. Then let's make an appointment. I'd be open for an interview if that's what you're looking for.
You know it, she says.
How does tomorrow afternoon sound? Say around this time?
No, York thinks. We don't have the time.
Can't we do it earlier, after you get out of work?
A slight pause.
I guess we can, if you don't mind meeting with me late. You see, my stocking job, it usually gets me off at about 2 a.m. Think you'll be up to seeing me then, before I go to sleep?
I'm sure I will be, York says.
Tell you what, we get off the phone here, I'll send you a text with directions to my place. How does that sound?
Sounds great, she says. We'll be there. The tone instantly changes.
Whoa. Who said anything about we? Who's this we? Your boss?
York quickly thinks and comes up with an answer.
No, he's working the case elsewhere. I was planning to bring one of my other investigators along.
Nope, she says.
Not going to happen. Either you by yourself or there's no meeting, got it?
York looks over at her three men.
All right, then it'll just be me, alone. Fine.
A pickup truck pulls in, sending up some dust from the restaurant's unpaved parking lot. York says,
May I ask why you only want me there?
Peggy says,
You may,
and then disconnects the call. York goes back to the picnic table, sits down. The three men look at her and she says,
That was the reporter from the local paper. I'm talking to her later tonight.
Sanchez says, What the hell do you want to do that for? I thought it was a mistake the first time you called her, back when you climbed out of the dumpster. Dealing with reporters is always a mistake. They all have an agenda, and they always screw up the story.
She picks up a plastic cup filled with sweet tea, takes a sip, and decides she's never drinking tea ever again.
Because the boss thought it would be a two-way street, me giving her a story, her giving us an idea of what the hell the local landscape is like. Right now, we're operating in a fog, only getting information that someone is tossing in our direction.
Pierce says, I think you're right, ma'am. Even with Staff Sergeant Jefferson changing his mind, it'd be helpful to know the background of the players around here. Finding out our rooms were bugged, seeing how two main witnesses have fled, and having the kill house burned down, it all points to trouble. Out on Route 119, a brown and white Sullivan County Sheriff's Department cruiser slows down and comes into the restaurant's parking lot. It stops in the middle and sits there. A male deputy sheriff in the front seat looks at them. Sanchez says, There's our trouble right there. That sheriff and her staff. You know, maybe talking to that reporter is a good idea after all.
York turns her head and stares at the deputy sheriff, a stocky, broad-shouldered young man who locks eyes with Connie. She stares right back and says,
"Well, Agent Sanchez, so nice to have you on board."
Huang says,
"Should we leave?"
Connie says,
"No, we stay. Let him leave first."
Pierce says, "Might take a while. Huang and I need to get to Ralston eventually."
She won't break the stare. To the JAG lawyer, she says,
"You two can head out. Me, I don't have a bus to catch."
The men stay put for the time being and the wait goes on. Then the cruiser slowly turns around and leaves the parking lot. York turns back to the three men and rubs her eyes.
"Looks like you won that round, ma'am," Pierce says.
"Maybe so," she says. "But I'd love to know how many more rounds are waiting for us out there."
Chapter 59. In a small waiting area outside Chief Kane's office, the chief comes from a corridor leading into the jail's interior and shakes his head.
"Sorry, Dr. Huang, the ranger won't see no one but Captain Pierce here and Mr. Slate."
Huang just gives a slight nod of his head, but Pierce feels bad for the doc. Maybe it was the staff sergeant's decision, but the tone of the chief's message was that of the old voice telling those with a different skin hue in this part of the world to stay in their place. "All right, Doc," Pierce says, standing up and taking his briefcase with him. "I'll be back shortly. Don't do anything untoward and find yourself in one of these cells." Huang manages a smile.
"Maybe the food is better."
"Hate to say it, but you might be right."
He walks down the short and narrow concrete block hallway with Chief Kane and asks, "Any idea when the district attorney is arriving?"
Kane says, "Just a few minutes. He called me from his car. I'll make sure he gets in with you and Staff Sergeant Jefferson."
They're outside a heavy metal door with a sign saying, "All conversations subject to audio and video recording." Pierce says, "Staff Sergeant Jefferson has requested me to be here. You'll make sure that all recording devices are switched off?"
"They already are," he says.
"You sure?" His eyes flash with anger.
"Positive."
"Glad to hear it," Pierce says as the chief unlocks the door. "Again, any idea what's on Jefferson's mind?"
"Not a clue."
Pierce enters the interview room, and it seems the chief takes great satisfaction in slamming the door shut. The small room is depressingly similar to others Pierce has visited over the years, although those were always at army posts. But this one would fit right in with its pale green concrete block walls, scuffed tile floor, and round table with four light orange plastic chairs. The door opens and Cornelius Slate comes in, smiling, wearing a seersucker suit with a white shirt and a red bow tie. He looks like the stereotype of a southern lawyer, complete with sweat stains around his armpits. Pierce so wants to punch that older man in the face, but he restrains himself, and after a brief handshake, Slate takes the seat across from him and drops his black leather briefcase on the table.
"Damn hot today, isn't it?" he says. "Last week of October and election day's next Tuesday, but it still feels like the middle of August."
"I didn't notice," Pierce says. The district attorney opens his briefcase, smirks.
"That makes sense now, don't it?"
It doesn't make sense, but Pierce knows what the lawyer is driving at. "Your ancestors worked the field, so I'm sure you're used to the heat."
He says,
"This is a bit of a surprise, the staff sergeant asking to see us both. Do you have any idea what he's seeking?"
A shake of the head. "Nope, but I imagine we'll find out. Well, like now."
One more opening of the door and Kane escorts Staff Sergeant Jefferson into the interview room. This is the first time Pierce has met with the ranger, and he's immediately impressed with his size and bearing. Even wearing an orange prison jumpsuit and with his hands cuffed in front of him, Jefferson looks like a man at ease, entirely comfortable with who he is and where he is. Pierce wishes he had Huang next to him, looking and observing with his psychiatry skills. Jefferson takes a seat. Kane says,
"Staff Sergeant, I'll leave you be with these two gentlemen. Mr. Slate, Captain Pierce, if either of you wants to leave, just knock on the door. One of my folks is stationed right outside and they'll take care of you."
The chief leaves, closes the door behind him, and Jefferson says,
"You're Captain Pierce, the JAG lawyer?"
"That's right," Pierce says, taking out a yellow legal pad and pen.
Now, before we begin, I need to tell you, Staff Sergeant, that if you're requesting me to represent you, then... Jefferson says,
I don't want your counsel. I still plan to represent myself.
Pierce slowly puts the legal pad and pen down on the dirty round table. I'm sorry, Sergeant, I don't understand. Then why did you want me to be here? The large ranger nods in the direction of the district attorney.
Because I want you to hear what I'm going to say to this fine gentleman here, and make sure there are no misunderstandings or future disagreements. You think you can do that for me, Captain?
Pierce says. This is very unorthodox. Jefferson grins.
I'm an unorthodox ranger. You're Mr. Slate, right? The district attorney?
That's right,
Slate says, and Pierce is pleased to see that the man looks as confused as he is.
What do you have in mind?
Jefferson says.
Remind me, my guys and I are facing a judge in 2 days, on Thursday, right?
That's correct, Slate says.
And what kind of hearing is it?
An arraignment, Slate says. You could also make a request for bail, but due to the circumstances of this case, you shouldn't waste your time.
Then what? Slate says.
Next step will be a hearing before a grand jury, the indictment, and then the entire process gets going. I expect you and your fellow rangers will face trial 8 or 9 months down the road, if not longer.
Pierce knows all of this due to his research, but wonders what the ranger is planning. This is all straightforward, all by the book. And in the next 10 seconds, Pierce is stunned at what he hears. Jefferson says,
Yep, I know all that, but I also know that there's a way to short-circuit this whole process.
Slate says, Sergeant Jefferson, I don't have time for your amateur lawyering. I suggest you work with Captain Pierce here, and...
Jefferson says, Nope, not going to happen. But I will tell you what will happen this Thursday when I appear in front of that judge. I plan to stand there and look him right in the eye and plead guilty to all charges.
Chapter 60. Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson enjoys seeing the shock and confusion on both of these lawyers' faces, even the Army one who's supposedly looking out for his interests. They may be high-priced and highly educated lawyers, and he might be an Army grunt and in handcuffs sitting in front of them, but he has the sweet, sweet feeling of being totally in charge. Pierce says, Sergeant Jefferson, I'm not your official legal representative, but that... Slate cuts him off.
Just like that? You want to plead guilty?
I certainly do, Jefferson says. In open court and in front of that judge and the world. But I want something in exchange.
The district attorney still looks shocked.
Like what?
This is it. And Jefferson recalls a time back in Afghanistan, early one morning, responding to a Taliban ambush on a narrow mountain trail and letting the training kick in. Anyone else facing the incoming AK-47 fire and RPG rounds would run away or go to ground. But Jefferson did what he had to do, what was right, which was to charge straight at the attackers, not giving up an inch. Like now.
You'll get a guilty plea from me, Mr. District Attorney, and in exchange, you'll let my 2 guys go free. Completely and 100% off the hook. Got that?
The JAG lawyer says, Sergeant Jefferson, you can't do this.
Sure I can, he says, smiling. Mr. District Attorney here, give him some time. He can draw up all the legal papers and I'll sign them. But you, Mr. JAG, I need you to look over them, cut through the legal mumbo-jumbo, and you tell me in straight Army talk that what I'm signing is what I want. I plead guilty to the murders, take my sentence like a man, and my 2 guys get freed and nothing happens to them down the road. Not a damn thing.
Slate says, I can't guarantee that the Department of Justice won't want to look into it if there's a public outcry. The other 2 rangers might be charged with federal offenses.
Jefferson says, That's out of your control. That's okay. I'm a reasonable guy.
The JAG lawyer turns to Slate and says,
You can't be considering this. This isn't justice.
The district attorney doesn't say anything. Jefferson says,
Sure, he's considering it, Captain Pierce. Why not?
He can say he got a conviction without the pain or expense of a lengthy trial. I take the fall, he looks good to the voters, and justice is done.
But the forensic evidence, the JAG lawyer says.
Jefferson says, I've heard about the forensic evidence. All points to me, right? Nothing connecting the squad.
The district attorney nods.
Seems that way.
Wait, the army captain says. There was a witness seeing you leave that place with at least one other ranger.
The district attorney says, well, that's true, Captain, but just because he was at the scene doesn't mean he took part in the killing.
Jefferson nods, feels that the district attorney is coming his way.
My fingerprints are in that house. Empty shell casings from my weapon. And what those clowns did to my stepdaughter. The district attorney can step up before the judge, say he got a deal and I murdered all those folks because I snapped. Right? Every time there's a war, there are always stories about the crazy vets who come back and lose it. I'm just the latest one, right? I found out my daughter nearly died from an OD, and I snapped. Went in there and murdered everyone. The end.
Jefferson waits. The JAG attorney says, this isn't right. The district attorney says,
you heard the staff sergeant. You're just here as a witness, not to act as his defense, Captain Pierce.
Jefferson says,
that's right, Captain. And if you don't cooperate, well, I'll get somebody else in here to do the job. But one way or another, it's going to happen. The district attorney is going to draw up a plea agreement that I'll sign, and he's going to write up some official papers that my guys are going to be cut loose, with no chance of any prosecution today or tomorrow or 50 years from now. A pause, he adds. What do you say, Mr. District Attorney? Want to give my guilty plea? Save the county the expense of a trial? Get this case put away day after tomorrow when I appear before the judge? Help you get reelected?
The district attorney smiles.
Son, you got yourself a deal.
Chapter 61. Special Agent Connie York is in her motel room, sitting cross-legged on the saggy and scratchy platform that claims to be a bed, when there's a heavy knock on the door. Her laptop is in front of her and she's trying to figure out what time Major Cook is getting into Bagram, and why in hell Afghanistan insists on having their time zone 30 minutes off instead of on the hour like other countries. She puts her laptop aside and goes to answer the door. Standing outside by the door is the motel's manager, a squat, greasy-looking man named Farnsworth, wearing dark green pants, a white t-shirt, and suspenders. A taller, skinnier man wearing stained gray dress pants, a white dress shirt, and a blue necktie is standing next to the manager, and a uniformed deputy sheriff is standing just a few feet away. Yes? She asks. Farnsworth rubs his chubby hands together, looks embarrassed, and says,
Mrs. York, I...
Special Agent York, please, she says. What's wrong? The manager looks at the other men for support.
Well, I'm sorry we have a situation here. This is Henry Abbott, the health inspector for the county, and he's got an official order, and I'm sorry I have to follow what he has to say.
Connie knows exactly what's coming and says, what is it, Mr. Abbott? Mold in the walls? Poor electrical connections? He shakes his head, holds out a folded sheet of paper.
Sprinkler system out of order in this wing of the motel. Sorry, it's a health hazard indeed. If a fire were to break out, you folks could be seriously injured, or worse.
The door next to hers swings open and Special Agent Manuel Sanchez comes out, yawning, scratching at his lower back, and then instantly stopping at seeing the three men outside Connie's room. He steps over and says, what's going on? Connie says, we're being kicked out for health reasons. It seems the sprinkler system in this place is out of order and the county is ordering us to leave our rooms. Sanchez looks at the deputy sheriff.
And that fella in the nice brown and tan uniform is going to make sure we comply, right, deputy?
The deputy says, just the law, folks. You need to depart the premises straight away. Please don't make any trouble.
Connie thinks of her meeting with the local newspaper reporter, only a few hours from now. No, at the moment we won't do that, she says. Mr. Farnsworth, any chance you have some spare rooms on the other side of the motel?
He shakes his head. Not a one. Not with all those damn reporters.
And can you recommend any other place in the county where we can stay? For the briefest of moments, she sees the manager look at the deputy,
and the deputy looks back. And there, without a word, is the answer.
I see, she says.
Sanchez, start packing. When Pierce and Huang get back, they'll do the same. An hour later, after Pierce has briefed her and the others on Jefferson's plan to plead guilty in less than 2 days, good Lord, what a day this has turned out to be, she and the men are outside in the dark of the parking lot, luggage at their feet, standing next to their rental Fords. While the motel manager and the health inspector have left, the deputy sheriff has remained, casually leaning against the front fender of his cruiser. Sanchez says,
Sorry, Connie. I mean, ma'am. There's not a single damn motel room available anywhere near here. The nearest is in Georgetown.
York stares at the deputy sheriff.
Remind me, is Georgetown in Sullivan County?
No, Sanchez says as Huang and Pierce look on. It's in Chatham County.
Connie picks up her bags, goes to the trunk of the nearest Ford. No, we're not leaving Sullivan County. Not tonight and not until the job is over. She opens the trunk and Pierce says,
Ma'am, what do we do? I mean, what do we do in the meantime?
Connie slams the trunk down.
I once pulled a 12-hour surveillance on a drug mule who was supposed to show up at a welcome center in Fredericksburg on I-95. But my relief never showed up and I had to spend a whole day and night in my car.
She gives her squad a good, hard, determined look.
You get used to it.
Chapter 62. Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson is lying awake on his bunk sometime after midnight, when a shadow passes by outside in the dim light, and Chief Kane appears in front of the barred door to his cell. Across the corridor, Specialist Pauly Ruiz is doing what he does best when he's sleeping. Snoring.
You have a visitor, Kane says.
Pretty late.
Don't care, he says.
Well, I'm your guest at this fine facility, and I care.
Ruiz's snoring goes on, and in the darkness, Jefferson smiles. Some would hate the noise, but after months of serving with the specialist, Jefferson finds it comforting, soothing, something that's part of his life.
Don't matter, the chief says. Your visitor wants to see you now.
Jefferson crosses his legs.
Sorry, it's after visiting hours and I'm pretty damn comfortable where I am, Kane says.
Okay, Sergeant Jefferson,
Staff Sergeant.
All right, Staff Sergeant Jefferson, you're a badass. I know that and you know that, nothing to prove. But if you don't get up and prep for a visit, I'll call in my two brothers-in-law. They always wanted to be police, but were too dumb to pass the test. But they'll come in if I call them. And then I'll open this cell door, pepper spray you hard. And then my two idiot brothers-in-law will taser you until you wet your pants. Then I'll put you in restraints, and then you'll make your visit, and at the end you'll still be a badass, and we'll all know you're a badass.
Jefferson laughs, swings off the bunk, and comes over to the cell door.
Chief, that's pretty good.
Okay. Kane moves around, and there's a rattling noise, and something has slid underneath the door. Jefferson bends over, picks up a wide leather belt with manacles and chains too long enough to reach his ankles.
What's this? He asks.
Your visitor knows you're a badass too, Kane says, just taking precautions.
A few minutes later, as Jefferson shuffles along the corridor with his ankles shackled, his cuffed wrists secured by chains to the wide leather belt, Kane opens the interview door and Jefferson shuffles in. Sitting across the table is Sullivan County Sheriff Emma Williams. She's in civvy clothes, blue jeans, and a black t-shirt, but her hard face and sharp eyes remind Jefferson of a Pashtun woman he once saw, who had her burqa accidentally torn off when it got caught in a bus door. The look on her face toward the U.S. soldiers standing around her was the same as she sees here from the sheriff. A raging anger barely held under control, a face failing to hide the thoughts of revenge, sharp knives and flesh being carved out.
Sit down, she says.
And he gives her that victory, sitting a bit clumsily with all the shackles fixed to his waist, ankles, and wrists.
Good to see you too, he says.
The stone-cold, angry look on her face doesn't change.
We had an arrangement, a deal, an agreement.
We did, Jefferson says. An arrangement with me and my three rangers. Now there's only two other rangers. The circumstances have changed. The deal has changed. William says,
No, it hasn't.
Well, so says you, Jefferson says. But right now there's signed paperwork with your district attorney witnessed by an army lawyer that says otherwise.
The district attorney, he works for me, William says. You won't get away with it.
He smiles. Give it your best, Sheriff, but it won't work. Guarantee it.
She moves her chair over so she's closer to him, lowers her voice.
You sign those papers. You sign the obituary for you and your rangers. This is my county, my land, and I make the rules. Remember that.
Jefferson scrapes his chair closer to.
Here's a story for you, Sheriff. Non-PC, so I apologize in advance.
I don't have time for your tales, she says.
He says, Oh, you'll love this story. Once upon a time, an Air Force plane was flying over a remote part of New Guinea when it crashed in a storm. There were three survivors, an Air Force airman, a Navy seaman, and an Army Ranger. They were captured by a tribe of headhunters, see, I told you it wasn't PC, and the chief said that there were trespassers on his sacred soil and that they were all sentenced to death. But the method of their deaths was up to them. The chief said if they each committed suicide, their skins would be tanned and turned into sacred canoes, and their spirits would live forever among the tribe. If not, then they'd suffer weeks of torture before dying anyway. On a wooden table were a number of weapons. Faced with this horrible choice, the airman picked up a poison capsule, took it, and said, Hooray for the Air Force. The seaman saw a rusty revolver with one round in it, and before shooting himself in the head, said, Hooray for the Navy. Jefferson grins at seeing the sheriff hanging on his every word. Then it came to the Army Ranger. He saw the table full of weapons and then went to another table, which had kitchen utensils, picked up a long, two-tined fork, and started stabbing himself furiously, up and down his arms, legs, even his chest and abdomen, punching it in, and soon he was bleeding from dozens of wounds. Just before he passed out from blood loss, the tribal chief said, Why did you pick such a painful way to die? And the army guy looked up and said, I'm an Army Ranger. Fuck you and your sacred canoe.
Jefferson stands up, heads to the door where he will hammer on the door and ask to go back to his cell.
Same to you, Sheriff, he says.
Chapter 63. Special Agent Connie York spots the correct street number on the mailbox marking the home of Peggy Reese of the Sullivan County Times, and she parks the Ford sedan a few yards up the road. They are in a small housing development of double-wide trailers with carports. After Cook's orders hours back, Sanchez spent some time under both vehicles, searching the undercarriages with a flashlight, and said, Looks clean. I don't think they're tracking us in our rentals. As she switches off the engine, hands the keys over to Sanchez, she thinks this was at least one bit of good news before they all started this early Wednesday morning.
I've got my phone and I've got my service weapon, Connie says.
I still don't like it, Sanchez says. For all we know, that woman is a cousin of the sheriff and is ready to take a wrench to your head. You know how everybody down here is always somebody's uncle, aunt, second or third cousin.
York opens the door.
Well, if that's true, let's hope she's estranged.
She walks up the asphalt and then along the driveway. A dog is barking somewhere. And up ahead, a light is on over the front door. Flying insects are making a moving halo around the globe. One knock on the door is all it takes, and a slim woman with cotton-white hair opens the door.
Right on time, Peggy Reese says, smiling. I like you already, Agent York, if that's who you are.
Connie digs out her wallet and badge, shows the identification.
This is who I am. Then come right in.
The inside of the home is clean and orderly, with two couches forming an angle, a kitchen off to the left, bookcases filled with hardcovers and paperbacks, and a coffee table with newspapers on top, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Peggy is wearing black slacks and a yellow and blue Walmart smock, which she tugs off and tosses to the floor. Underneath, she has on an old Allman Brothers concert t-shirt, and two large black and white cats come tumbling into the living room, hitting each other with their paws. "Roscoe, Ario, knock it off," she says, scooping them up in her arms, giving each a quick nuzzle, and then tossing each onto a separate couch where they land safely and expertly. She turns and says, "You know what you call two cats?"
"I don't know," Connie says, liking the woman.
"A herd? A pride? A duo?"
Peggy smiles. "A crazy cat lady starter kit. Get you a drink before we begin?"
Connie shakes her head.
"No, it's too late, and officially I'm on duty."
"Hun, wasn't going to offer you liquor," she says. "I like a cold lemonade after a shift. Cleans out the dust and bullshit in my mouth."
"I'd love one," she says.
"Be right back," Peggy says. "Sit on a couch. Hope you like cats. Roscoe and Ario don't think I get enough visitors, and they're right. As long as you're here, they'll be either sniffing your hair or biting your feet."
A few minutes later, she's sipping on a glass of cold, fresh lemonade, the best Connie's ever had, and Peggy has a reporter's notebook and pen in hand. She says, "Mind if we get to work? Won't make Wednesday's paper, but if all goes well, it should appear in the Thursday one."
Connie stifles a yawn.
"I'll do the best I can, but some things I can't comment on."
Peggy flips a page in the slim notebook.
"Fair enough. Mind telling me your official rank and name and where you're from?"
"Special Agent Connie York, U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Division, stationed in Quantico, Virginia."
"And you got a major running the show down here?" she says. "Older fella who's limping, where is he?"
Connie says,
"He's been called away."
"I see," she says.
"Where?"
"I can't tell you."
The reporter smiles.
"Oh, this is gonna be fun."
Connie says, "You might not think it's fun when your part is done."
"Oh?
I need some information about this county," she says.
"Right now, you're it."
The reporter's smile fades.
"Let's just wait and see, all right?"
15 minutes later, Connie is exhausted. Despite the woman's age and the rural county she lives in and the small paper she works for, Peggy is good. Sharp, inquisitive, and when Connie dodges a comment, the older woman doesn't complain. She just nods and circles back, and a while later tries again. Connie has dealt with reporters over the years, during her time in the Virginia State Police and through her Army service, but this woman, who has one of the black and white cats sitting on her shoulders throughout, is one of the best reporters Connie has ever encountered. Peggy scribbles some more, looks up and says,
"Well, seems like that's about as much as I'm going to squeeze out of you this morning about what happened at the summer house, the poor place."
The notebook slaps shut. Connie says,
"My turn now.
Not sure if I can help you."
"But you know this county. You know the people."
Peggy carefully says,
"Not as much as you'd think."
"But you're a reporter here."
"Not always," Peggy says. "I've only been here 5 or so years.
"Aren't you from Sullivan?" Peggy bursts out laughing.
"Crap, no. Gad, is my accent that thick? No, I'm from North Carolina originally. This double Y belonged to a distant uncle who passed on, and I was the nearest relative it was awarded to. Nope, went up to the University of Richmond for my degree in journalism, got my master's at Columbia, went to work for the Times-Dispatch in Richmond, did some bureau work for the Associated Press, and then went to the Washington Post."
The other cat jumps into her lap, and she scratches its head. Even from across the room, Connie can hear the loud purrs.
Peggy says, "Special Agent York, I'm a drunk. Or alcoholic, if you prefer. Time came at the Post when early retirement was offered, and it was gently suggested that I depart. So I did. And when I woke up and dried out a couple of years later, here I was."
"I see," Connie says. The woman keeps on rubbing the cat's head. The purring stays constant.
"Peggy, what can you tell me about this county?"
The reporter doesn't meet her eye, just keeps on rubbing and rubbing.
"It's a county, no better and no worse than most counties, I guess."
"Then Sheriff Williams," Connie says. "You've been here long enough to know her quite well. What's she like?"
"Our blessed Emma Williams, High Sheriff of Sullivan County?" Peggy asks. "She's a fair, loving, and incorruptible law enforcement officer who is devoted to public service." The words say one thing. The woman's tone says quite another. "Peggy." "Oh, what does it matter?" Peggy says. "In a day or two, you army folks will be gone from Sullivan County. Those of us who stay here, who can't or won't move, we'll still be around to have Sheriff Williams as our local and friendly chief law enforcement officer." "It matters a lot," Connie says. "If it can make a difference in our investigation. Please, Peggy, tell me what you know." Peggy looks up, eyes strained and worried. "Any way you can protect me?" Connie says. "Truthfully, probably not." She slowly nods. "The truth. A pretty rare jewel in this county." Peggy takes a breath. "All right. Emma Williams is sheriff of Sullivan County, and she runs the biggest criminal enterprise in this part of Georgia. Not a gallon of moonshine, bale of marijuana, or kilo of crystal meth gets moved around or sold here without her knowledge, approval, and cut of the proceeds." The room is silent. The cat's purrs are still loud. Peggy says, "Think that'll make a difference?"
Chapter 64. After Connie York gave him the keys, Special Agent Manuel Sanchez switched to the driver's seat and started up the car, then drove down the road a number of yards, turned around, and headed back up to the house where the newspaper reporter lives. When he was at a point where he could see the house and where the car wasn't lit up by a street lamp, he pulled over and switched off the engine. Now he waits. Something they never show in cop shows or movies is just how much waiting there is. You wait for a warrant to be delivered from a judge. You wait at a suspect's house. And most of all, you wait for a shift to end so you can go home safe to your family. A cop's most important job. Lights appear at the end of the street, coming this way. Sanchez slides down so he isn't silhouetted by the approaching headlights. They grow brighter and then dim as the car enters a driveway, backs out, and then returns the other way, parking right in front of the newspaper reporter's house. He sees the light bar across the roof of the car. A near streetlight illuminates a cruiser from the Sullivan County Sheriff's Department. How about that? Sanchez thinks. He slides up and takes a better view. Looks like one deputy in the front seat, just sitting, watching. A flare of light and the deputy lights up a cigarette. That just pisses off Sanchez. It's bad enough the sheriff's department here is up to some nasty business concerning the Rangers, but this is just insulting, blatantly parking in front of the reporter's house where York is, letting her know that every trip, every interview is being tracked. Insulting it is. Sanchez reaches up, switches off the dome light, and then opens the door, steps out. In the darkness, he smiles, just like the old days. Not like most of his past cases in the CID, tracking down a missing M240 machine gun or checking payroll receipts to see if some army clerk has been skimming. This is going to be fun. He smells cigarette smoke, gets closer to the open cruiser window. From his coat pocket, he pulls out an object and shoves the hard edge against the deputy's neck. "Hands on the steering wheel right now," he snaps out, and the cigarette is dropped on the pavement, where Sanchez stubs it out. Hey, do you know? Shut up," Sanchez says, pushing into the deputy's neck harder. "Hands on the steering wheel. Don't you do anything else but breathe." The deputy follows the instructions, and in the faint light from the interior, it seems like his hands are shaking. "Good," Sanchez says. "You got poor training and situational awareness going on there, deputy. You wouldn't last an hour in any big city department. What's your name?" "Dix," the deputy says. "What the hell are you doing here?" The deputy's voice is shaky. "I was ordered here." "Who gave you the order?"
"Sheriff Williams."
"What are you supposed to do, arrest the people in the house?"
No, just keep an eye on the place. Make it public so they know they're being watched."
Sanchez says, "What's the point?" The deputy falls silent. Sanchez knows he's treading on thin ice and makes it quick. "Answer me and then I'll let you be.
Why does the sheriff want the people there to know they're being watched?
Dick says, Sheriff Williams wants the army out of here, period. The end. Put enough pressure on them, she figures they'll leave.
Why? The man emits a nervous laugh.
Mister, go ahead, pull the trigger, blow my brains over the windshield.
A year ago, some deputy was giving her a hard time about paperwork, overtime, shit like that, and he said he was going to make a complaint to the GBI. We never heard from him again, never. He just got up and disappeared.
Sanchez thinks he's pushed his luck in this guy too far. He says, time for you to slip out, deputy. You just leave and tell the sheriff you did your job, that you were seen and that you're doing your part to spread hate and discontent. Knowing he's going to live, the deputy seems to find a stronger voice.
And who the hell are you?
A concerned bystander, Sanchez says. Now get going or your sheriff will get a call that you screwed up the job. Take one hand off the steering wheel, start up, and drive away nice and slow. The deputy's right hand goes down, the cruiser starts up, and he says, Mister, you better hope I never run into you again. Threatening a police officer with a gun is serious business. Sanchez pulls his hand back, gently slaps the deputy on the cheek. What's the charge for threatening a cop with a smartphone case? Get going. He steps aside and the cruiser speeds off. He turns and looks at the house where Cook and the journalist are talking about the case and, more important, what the hell is going on here in this county. Sanchez puts the smartphone back into his coat pocket, removes his Sig Sauer from his waist holster, goes back to the Ford. But instead of getting back into the rental, he sits on the damaged hood, weapon in hand, doing what most cops do. Waits.
Chapter 65, Afghanistan.
For the past half hour or so, the acid knot in my stomach has been outweighing the pain in my left leg as we make the final approach to Bagram. I've been running through various options and scenarios in my mind of how to get off this aircraft once it lands and comes to a halt, and what to do afterward. Bagram has grown tremendously since we got here post 9/11, and I remember talking to some old hands who were here back then, looking at all the broken-up Soviet aircraft that had been left behind. When we eventually get the hell out, this old reserve colonel told me, I can guarantee we'll do a better job cleaning up. But what's waiting for me now? I stop thinking as the huge aircraft makes a sharp dive and turn, and I grab onto a seat strap to keep from falling over. One of the Rangers spots me and yells out, Nothing to worry about, sir. Just a bit of evasive maneuvering, keeping any Taliban out there on their toes. I nod and thanks, my stomach clenched. And I think again of what's waiting for me, which is going to be trouble. Without the proper travel authorizations and other paperwork, I'm going to be in country quite illegally. Not only that, I'm also going to have to figure out a way of getting out of Bagram into a village called Pendahar. Lots of figuring. No ready answers. The engine noise changes pitch and there's a heavy clunk-clunk as the C-17's landing gear is deployed. I hold my cane in my hands. My rucksack is on the deck, my Bruce Catton book tucked back inside. Across from me, the three Rangers look to be talking among themselves. Thump. On the pavement. No windows to see what's out there, but in my mind's eye, I remember from a Black Hawk helicopter ride I took here during my last deployment. Rows of CH-47 transport helicopters, Apache attack helicopters, Kiowa reconnaissance helicopters. Hangars, clusters and clusters of square buildings, heavy equipment, concrete blast walls with rolls of concertina wire on top, mountains in the distance. And at nearly 5,000 feet in elevation, the air here is cool at night and thin. The engines change pitch again as the pilots slow down. What now? Out there in Bagram is a small CID satellite office I once used for a few weeks during my last tour. If I can get there, and if Quantico hasn't contacted them, I might be able to do some razzle-dazzle, get some cooperation from the CID warrant officers stationed here. Like back when I was in the NYPD. There were also procedures and directives to follow when interacting with other detectives in other precincts, but they were mostly ignored.
You needed help, you needed information, you either picked up the phone or dropped by the other precinct house. The C-17 continues to slow down, maneuvers again. My breathing quickens. The small CID office is on Putnam Road in Bagram, some distance from this main runway. I'll be walking with a cane. How long to get there? And will I make it? The C-17 sighs to a halt. Lights flicker on inside the huge fuselage. I unbuckle the straps and move, and I clench my teeth in agony. My cane falls, and I lean down to pick it up, breathing hard. When I sit up, the three rangers are standing in front of me. One squats down. African-American male, a sergeant, and he says, "That true? What we heard back in Germany? You here to help out some rangers from Alpha Company?" "That's right." "They being railroaded?" "Looks possible," I say. "Which ones?" he asks. "Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson and his team." Another ranger snorts. "Assholes," he says. But the sergeant says, "Yeah, but our assholes." "Come along, Major. We're going to help you off." "You don't have to," I say. But he nods to the other two men and says, "You can't hardly move, and you got something important to do." The other two rangers come to me and lift me out of my seat, and the sergeant grabs my rucksack. "Let's get moving, Major. Time's a-wasting." The next long minutes drag by in a painful blur as the three rangers manhandle me off the parked C-17 as we pass the secured pallets of equipment while the aircraft's loadmaster lowers the rear ramp. Instantly, the wind and the harsh smells of Afghanistan batter me, and I try not to panic at the memories of being in that shattered Humvee, the vehicle burning, trapped, smelling my own flesh starting to cook off. It's near noon local time, and in the distance, two twin rotor Chinook helicopters are taking off. I find it hard to catch my breath because of the thin air, but the bulky and armed rangers move like they're college boys on spring break, relaxed and strong. I fade in and out, and there's talking, more soldiers around, and we pause outside a hangar. I want to ask what's happening, and the sergeant returns to me and says, "We've got an open window of about 10 minutes, Major, before somebody official comes over to check us in. Where can we take you?" "Putnam," I say. "Putnam Road." He strides away with confidence, and I take in the sheer size and noise of Bagram. Then the other two rangers flank me, holding me up, and a minute or two pass before I'm bundled into an unarmored Humvee, and we drive away. Eventually, we're traveling down Baskin Road, and there's traffic going back and forth, and civilian workers walking by wearing orange reflective vests, lanyards holding their identification bouncing around their necks. I'm in the rear with one of the rangers who's been holding me up, and he says, "Can you believe this damn place has a Pizza Hut? Can you believe that?" The Humvee comes to a halt at the intersection of Baskin and Putnam. The sergeant turns away from the steering wheel and says, "End of the line, Major. We need to get our asses back before we get in the shits. Good luck, sir." Some hustle and bustle, and now I'm alone at this dusty intersection. My heavy rucksack on my aching back, cane in my hand, and my breathing is still labored as I turn and limp my way down Putnam Road. As I move along the narrow road past tan-colored ribbed cargo containers, squat concrete one- or two-story buildings, blast walls, and utility poles, I run through my mind what I'm going to say, and how I'm going to say it when I arrive at the CID office. Two heavy-set bearded contractors walk past me, nodding, and both have sympathy in their eyes at seeing me struggle along. Probably think I'm one dedicated trooper sticking to his job, and I know that's not true. Months ago, I left this place and attempted to put everything away in a box and on a shelf, but the smells and the wind and the constant noise of generators and aircraft taking off and landing are bringing it all back. I even remember the last time I was here in Bagram, working with local MPs, an FBI agent, and two women investigators from SIGAR, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, as we arrested two National Guard engineers from Alaska who were faking invoices and work orders so they could sell fuel oil to local Afghan merchants. A long time ago, a simple crime. I don't know if I'll ever again recognize a simple crime.
Up ahead now, to the CID office, and maybe I can get some coffee, something to eat, as I try to convince them to get me from here to the village of Pendahar. I stop. The familiar tan-colored concrete cube of a building is right where I remember it, but there's been a change. The metal front door is padlocked shut. The two small windows have metal shutters drawn down. The colorful sign marking the CID presence is gone, leaving just four empty bolt holes in the concrete.
Damn it!
A male voice speaks up behind me.
Sir? Is that you, Major Cook?
I pretend not to hear the inquiring voice and do my best to quickly limp down a side alley.
Sir!
Another voice barks out.
You need to come with us!
I grit my teeth, increase my walking speed. It's all I can do.
Chapter 66. Across from Special Agent Connie York, Peggy Reese says,
There, you made me talk. Proud of yourself? Just remember, you can do your job and then leave, and we few innocents will be around to face whatever wrath will rise up. I'm glad you said what you said, York says. But I'm surprised that... Surprised. I thought an army investigator like you wouldn't be shocked by nearly anything. You'd be wrong, she says. It's just that in these times, I can't see how... You can't see how a woman like her could get away with it? Peggy asks, scratching the chin of one of her cats, her voice harsh. There's 159 counties in the great state of Georgia. What, you think all of them are run on the straight and narrow? You don't think there are opportunities for graft and corruption? But your newspaper, I mean, Peggy says, my newspaper is owned by Tyron Bogart, an old fogey who believes in one thing and one thing only, the bottom line. A good chunk of the paper's advertising comes from the county, printing legal notices, court settlements, stuff like that. His printing plant also prints up county documents. How long would the paper last if the county pulled its business? And if the county pressed on other advertisers to do the same if he ran stories that he should? The internet, sure, she says. When I've had bouts of bravery here and there, I've tried contacting other news organizations. From the Journal Constitution to USA Today to every TV station that broadcasts in Sullivan County. No dice. Haven't you read the news, Agent York? Newspapers and real reporting are dying. Nobody cares anymore about local news. It's all scandal all the time, whether from D.C. or Hollywood. Meanwhile, Sheriff Williams builds her little empire and staffs it, and only a few care, and those few keep their heads down. Otherwise, they get pulled over for going a mile over the speed limit, or their construction permits get turned down, or their electricity gets shut off for no good reason at all. York feels like she's been dropped into one of those old black-and-white movies with the cliché of the corrupt southern sheriff running a criminal enterprise, and she quickly remembers that every cliché has a basis of truth. How can she do it alone?
Peggy sighs.
She doesn't do it alone. Haven't you noticed her big, manly deputy sheriffs? She recruited them carefully, and...
It snaps too for York. How she thought she knew the deputies from somewhere before.
The military, Connie says. They're all from the military.
Half right, Peggy says.
Her deputies are all ex-military, but not the ones who've served and been honorably discharged. No, she picks up those who've been quietly separated by something called a failure to adapt discharge.
York says.
Enlistees who can't make it through the first 6 months, even if they've gone through their training and been deployed overseas.